It's the 4th of November 2011 and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio programme and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. If Plan A for the economy has failed, do we need a Plan B or are we all Plan F? Should we wear white poppies or are they only for wimps? Is the recent financial crisis a case of déjà vu? Should we turn a deaf ear to ear candling? And how pure is your scepticism? But first, as the world population hits 7 billion, has George Osborne been quantitatively easing people? It's been in the news this week that the world population has finally hit 7 billion. Whilst this isn't exactly true, no one can calculate it that precisely, it raised some interesting questions for humanity to consider, such as, who are all these fucking people getting right in my grill? But it turns out that it's not the developed world that will be bearing the brunt of the population increases, but parts of the developing world, such as the London Underground. To find out more, here's Michael Greyer.
So, 7 billion people then. That's a scarily large number. Wasn't it 6 billion only a few years ago? How did we grow so fast? It took us thousands of years to reach 1 billion, and then another 120 odd years to reach the second. And now we've gone from 6 to 7 billion in only 12 years? What's going on? Is population growth out of control? It seems intuitive that there should be some sort of link between population growth and environmental degradation. Thomas Malthus argued in his famous 1798 essay On the Principle of Population that an exponentially growing population would eventually outstrip food production, causing widespread famine. More mouths to feed means a greater drain on resources, right? Well, yes. Except that not everyone consumes resources equally. Put simply, the world's biggest consumers come from places where population growth has all but stopped. Growing populations are more likely to be suffering climate change's consequences, rather than contributing towards its taking place. How the environment affects changing populations is arguably a more relevant question to be asking than how changing populations affect the environment. Focusing solely on this magical 7 billion milestone number also misses several other demographic issues, in particular shifts in the age structure of the population. Population aging is now a major economic issue in many countries where fertility rates have fallen. Working out how to cope with growing numbers of retirees living for longer than ever before, with a shrinking workforce being left behind, is a much more imminent issue than any posed by crude population levels on their own. We also shouldn't be so surprised at hitting the 7 billion mark. Predicting future populations is in fact one of the more accurate exercises in predicting the future that there is. This is because many of the people who make up a population, say 30, 40, 50 years from now, are in fact already alive. And for the vast majority of the rest, their mothers are already alive. And we have a fairly good idea as to what time they will reach childbearing age, and have a reasonable guess as to the number of children they will have, on average, and when that will be. Fertility is the main driver behind population change. While longer life expectancies do contribute a little bit, changes in mortality only extend the lives of those who are already alive. Changes in fertility, however, determine how many people are put on the planet in the first place. What's more, the effect of lowering fertility through meeting demand for family planning is not immediately felt. It takes a very long time to apply any brakes to population growth. Even if the fertility rate drops universally overnight, the effects of this aren't fully realised until that generation reaches childbearing age themselves, some 20 to 40 years later. Which brings me round to close on a bit of optimism. Taking into account population predictions made by other organisations, such as the United States Census Bureau, or the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna, which suggests that the 7 billion mark will in fact be hit sometime between now and early 2013. The adding of the 7th billion to the world's population, which took place between 1999 to about now, took about the same length of time as it did to add the 6th, which took place between 1987 and 1999. Now this is the first time in history that this has happened. I think that this is good news. No longer are we experiencing exponential growth upon which Malthusian predictions of doom and gloom are based. The family planning initiatives which took place in many countries in the 70s, 80s and 90s are finally resulting in the brakes to population growth being applied. The next milestones, 8 and 9 billion, which will inevitably come to pass, are at least approaching more slowly than the most recent ones. There are still major demographic challenges to be met for our future world of close to 10 billion eventual inhabitants. One is ensuring that future demand for family planning will be met. Another is the reduction of resource consumption in places where it is currently excessive. And a third is coping with an ageing population. Focusing solely on a scary-looking, big and implausibly precise number detracts from these issues. Michael Greyer, the 79,064,366,175th person to have lived since history began, for the Pod Delusion.
The world breathed a sigh of relief this week as, thanks to a lack of snow and a lack of royal wedding, it was announced by George Osborne that growth in the last quarter was a staggering 0.5%. Maybe finally the government can remove all those harsh regulations they imposed on the banks following the financial crisis a few years ago. Oh, wait. A so-called Plan B has been unveiled this week by the campaign group Compass, though in this next report, Pratik Butch argues that we don't need a Plan B, but a Plan C. I assume Plan D is a post-apocalyptic dystopia sort of thing.
Now, unless you've been living under a rock for the last 3 or 4 years, you'll have noticed that the economy's not been doing so well of late. If you're to believe some of the more hysterical commentary out there, living under a rock might end up being the luxury option if you manage to survive the impending collapse of global capitalism. A collapse that, depending on who's telling the story, is either down to profligate governments recklessly spending beyond their means, or a heartless global elite intent on crushing the ordinary man's way of life. The truth, as I'm sure you realise, lies somewhere in between. But where exactly? How badly are we faring here in the UK? Is government economic policy making things better or worse? Do we need alternative ways of thinking on the economy? And if so, what should these look like? And where do those occupying Wall Street and St Paul's fit into all this? Now, we may not have all the answers here, but here are a few thoughts. Now, just in terms of crude indicators of economic performance, like gross domestic product, the recession we lived through in 2008 and 9 was the deepest and longest in living memory. In fact, compared to comparable Western developed countries, the UK has suffered from the slowest recovery from that recession as well, meaning that we're still a worse off country now than we were before the crash. That's worth bearing in mind. Things are pretty bad then, but optimists will tell you that there are only, in inverted commas, 2.5 million people out of work, and that by bailing out the banks, we averted the completely nightmare scenario of a total global financial collapse. So that things aren't that bad. I'm not so sure. I think most of us would say that whilst the manufacturing and construction sectors struggle, whilst, as we heard earlier this week, directors of the UK's 100 biggest firms have given themselves 49% pay rises, whilst many of us have to suffer with pay freezes if not losing our jobs, and crucially with unemployment in the under 25s group running at a staggering 21%, something remains rotten in the state of Denmark. Well, perhaps not so much in the state of Denmark itself, and we'll come back to that later. The question for here in the UK is whether swallowing the bitter pill of austerity, which the Chancellor George Osborne insists is the only cure for our economic problems, is causing side effects that are worsening our prospects of a healthy recovery. Now, broadly speaking, if I can continue the medical analogy, I'd say the side effects are serious, and that they stem from an initial misdiagnosis of what's wrong in our economy in the first place. Osborne's strategy to date has been one of expansionary fiscal contraction, hoping that by cutting public spending quickly, we would reduce our budget deficit, and that government would thereby get out of the way and reignite dynamic growth in the private sector. Trouble is, that plan A simply isn't working. More and more people are out of work, and that in itself reduces demand for goods and services, so it's little wonder that the private sector isn't stepping in. It was this recognition that demand was crucial that lay behind the campaigns group Compass launching their Plan B for the economy earlier this week, which offered an alternative to George Osborne's strategy. Plan B starts off by proposing an emergency recovery plan, which essentially combines more quantitative easing, printing money if you like, which this time would be aimed specifically at paying for green technology, with raising benefits and tax credits for the poor, and temporarily stopping spending cuts in the public sector. Plan B then calls for a series of measures, once the economy is stabilised, that would make our economy stronger and fairer in the long run. Things like reforming the financial services sector, encouraging green investment, and giving people a greater say in how the companies they work for are run. Now, all those longer-term measures are undoubtedly welcome, and we should take them seriously. But I think there are still crucial elements missing from Plan B. Since the summer, leading economists such as Lord Robert Skidelsky have been calling for a Plan C. Now, I've written in support of a Plan C, not for semantic reasons that I think C is better than B, but because I believe that if we separate temporary measures to shore up the economy from our long-term economic goals, we'll ultimately fail. And that's why Plan C, as I formulated it, doesn't call for a halt to spending cuts, just to make sure that we make cuts in public spending in a way that is sensitive to whether growth and other economic indicators are holding up well. Rather than cutting the budget deficit according to a rigid timetable, we should do so in a more subtle way. Also, Plan C would do more to try and crowd in some of the massive private sector surpluses that companies are sitting on right now, by recognising that only ventures between public and private sector are likely to create jobs and growth. And finally, I mentioned Denmark earlier on. Well, in countries like Denmark, other Scandinavian, Northern European countries, there's a recognition that capitalism necessarily involves cycles of boom and bust, creative destruction, if you like. And that what people really need is the security of knowing that if and when they lose their job, they'll be retrained and can find new work doing productive new things quickly. That sort of flexible labour market combined with the security of knowing that losing your job won't be the end of the world, called flexicurity, and that underpins the biggest difference between plans B and C, as far as I'm concerned. Now, the point is that although there are differences between the plan C that many of us have been talking about and plan B that was launched earlier in the week, there are many areas of overlap as well. Crucially, both approaches recognise that the economy that emerges from this depression must be fairer and more sustainable than that which went before. And this is what the function, as I see it, of the recent protests in Wall Street and St Paul's and all over the world is. Those protest movements aren't there to provide concrete answers about how better to run the economy. They're there to shift our horizons and to change the terms of debate. In economic terms, they're there to move the Overton window, if you like, Wikipedia that term, and they will spark, hopefully, a plural debate on how we can run the economy better. Now, this debate will continue, and plans B and C, I think, will have to make their way in some form into the government's thinking if we're to avoid a decade-long depression. The answers, as I said, aren't all contained in plans B or C. Both need developing, both need adding to. What's for sure is that Plan A is dead in the water. This has been Pratik Butch of the Social Liberal Forum, reporting for, I've always wanted to say this, the Pod Delusion.
Now, if you've been listening to the show for over a year, you may remember that last year we had a report challenging the idea of wearing a poppy for Memorial Day. We had pieces arguing for and against wearing them, and you can find a link to listen on the Pod Delusion website if you'd like to hear them again. But recently, despite being someone who pretends to be a journalist, I've discovered the concept of nuance, which is apparently when the issue is less than black and white, and more than just shouting yes or no. I know, I found it hard to believe at first too, but in a bold experiment for this year's Memorial Day coverage, we got Tessa Kendall to ask not whether wearing a poppy is a good thing, but which poppy to wear.
In 1933, the Cooperative Women's Guild produced white poppies to be worn on Armistice Day on November the 11th instead of the red ones. This is what became Remembrance Sunday. The Guild made it clear that the white poppy was not intended as an insult to the people who died in the Great War, and in fact it was a war in which many of these women lost men themselves. They saw it as a challenge to the continuing drive to war. In 1934, the Secular Peace Pledge Union, or the PPU, was founded. It joined the Guild in the distribution of poppies and later took over the project. Conscientious objectors, or pacifists, were often very badly treated during times of war, even though the Military Service Act of 1916 made it legal to object to fighting. Some of them went to war in non-combatant roles. For example, as stretcher bearers at the front where they faced great danger, and because they were conscientious objectors, they were not paid as the soldiers were. Others refused to have anything to do with the war effort at all. Objectors had to go before a tribunal, which was notoriously harsh, and there was no shortage of people, often women, handing out white feathers to cowards. Many objectors were religious, mostly Quakers, but not all of them. Many of the so-called conchies in the First World War were imprisoned in Richmond Castle in North Yorkshire. They were paraded through the town as a form of humiliation or threatened with execution. Life was also hard for their families dealing with the shame, and the objectors often found it hard to get work afterwards. Given the harsh treatment of the men who would not fight, they were hardly cowards. Ian Hislop made an excellent Channel 4 programme about them in 2008. In World War II, there were nearly 60,000 objectors under the National Services Armed Forces Act of 1939. Treatment was less severe, but they were still stigmatised. In some countries today, objectors are still very harshly treated. The British Forces Watch has issued recommendations on how the British forces should deal with objectors within its ranks. It states that the procedure for registering a conscientious objection is not safeguarding the rights of those in the armed forces, and, through lack of awareness, some could end up facing court-martial and a criminal conviction. The white poppies themselves are still not without controversy. For example, the Royal Canadian Legion is staunchly opposed to them. In 2007, the BBC's head of editorial policy said that TV presenters wearing anything other than the red poppy would undermine the trust of the audience. The White Poppy Project is also accused of diverting funds from the British Legion, who've been raising money for ex-service people since 1921. And some people see the pacifist ideals of the PPU as naive or misguided. So what colour poppy will I be wearing? I am broadly a pacifist, but not entirely. There are some justifiable wars, of course. I don't think we should have stayed out of World War II, for example. There are also morally justifiable interventions in other countries' wars. On the other hand, recent governments have been way too quick to get involved in overseas wars for less than honourable reasons. And I support the right of anyone to be a conscientious objector. Consequently, I bought a white poppy and will also be wearing a red one. It might appear over-liberal to be a pacifist, or in my case a semi-pacifist, but it's a genuinely held and considered moral position. And yes, I'm aware that as a woman I would never have been conscripted and had to act on my beliefs. For me, it's important to recognise the bravery and sacrifice both of people who fought to defend us and the ones who went to war in non-combatant roles or who followed their conscience and didn't go at all. And I'll explain this to people who ask why I'm wearing one or who are hostile. If you want a white poppy, you can buy them online from the Peace Pledge Union or from some outlets which they list on their website. I got mine from the Quaker House on Euston Road in London. This is Tessa Kendall reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now you may remember a few weeks ago we trailed the fact that next week, the week of the 7th of November, is non-profit week, and so we thought it might be wise to check in and see how plans are progressing. So the other day I spoke to Jenny Bartle, who's head of the AHS, the umbrella body representing university atheist, secularist and humanist groups, and started by asking her to remind us what non-profit week was all about.
Well, non-profit week is basically a secular charity fundraising week, which the AHS runs every year, and we do that basically because it kind of sometimes feels like charity is a religiously dominated thing. And a lot of people come out with claims that, oh, religious people are much more charitable than secularists or atheists. So we want to combat that and prove that we're really good people too, and we donate lots of money and do loads of charity too.
Excellent. So what's the plan? How are you going to motivate these godless heathens who have no morality, no values, no purpose, into caring about their fellow human being?
Well, it turns out they already do. And all we had to do was say, oh, we're doing a charity week. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I've got loads of stuff that I can do to raise money. So, yeah, we've had quite a lot of positive responses. Loads of people getting involved. Lots of societies all over the country.
Excellent. So give us some examples of what people are doing.
Well, I myself am doing Jenny Crayon, where you basically pay me to do whatever drawing you like. And then I make a little doodle and it'll turn out very cute, probably. The secretary, Mike Painter, he's doing a bike ride from Bristol to Birmingham, which is 100 miles. And as a very unfit man, he's really going to find that a challenge. So you'll really get your money's worth of pain and angst from that if you donate.
One of the bigger events is that the BHA choir are doing a sing-along. What's all that about?
Yeah, the BHA choir, they're doing a little workshop where you go along, give a little bit of money, and they teach you to sing some great godless BHA songs, which is great.
So if anyone listening wants to get involved, how can they raise money and add it to this big pot so they can go, I'm godless and I'm going to join in?
Well, they can either give money to some of the many events that are happening. A lot of them have online sponsorship pages. So if they go to the Nonprofit Week page, all of the Just Giving sponsorship pages are linked on there. So they can give directly, or they could decide on an event they want to do or a sponsorship they want to do. And there's a little button on our website where you can say your plans, where you can like email us and we'll add your plans to the list of things that are going on, and then hopefully people will click through and give money to you.
Hopefully we'll have an update next week on how everyone got along. I'm hoping some people are going to send some audio in of I want to hear Mike puffing and panting as he cycles along.
Well, a very good one that you can put a clip of on would be our head of membership. Jess is doing a personal serenade, so you give her some money and she sings you a song. So that would be a great thing to have on a clip.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we'll do that, and we'll put links to find out about all of this on the Pod Delusion website, and we'll catch up next week to find out how it all went.
Yay.
Brilliant. Jenny Bartle, President of the AHS, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In this next report, Cash Farouk talks about a crackpot who thinks that AIDS can be tackled with herbal remedies, rather than, you know, actual medicine that actually works. Remarkably, there was plans for the Science Museum to give him a platform at an event they were hosting, which I guess is a bit like, say, the Republican Party giving a platform to someone who is actually sane. Here's Cash, as read by Alex Foster.
The Science Museum has an offshoot called the Dana Centre. They have a bar area where they hold great free talks, ranging from Lewis Dartnell speaking about astrobiology to Professor Steve Jones discussing the fragility of the natural world. I'm on the mailing list. Their email newsletter is one that I don't bin straight away. I read through every event to see what the upcoming talks are. In the October newsletter, I spotted the following in the description for a talk titled An African Perspective on African and Western Medicines. The quote goes, "The EU has banned African herbal treatments, traditional medicines, and health products." Alarm bells started ringing. The EU has not banned them. Under the Traditional Herbal Medicinal Products Directive, a manufacturer just has to show it has been used for 30 years, with 15 of them being in the EU, and that there are no reported cases of side effects. It also requires that the manufacturer follow good manufacturing procedures to ensure that the products are less likely to be adulterated or contaminated. I didn't investigate any further and just passed the email on to the Nightingale Collaboration, an organisation that has an objective of challenging misleading healthcare claims. They quickly came back to me. My alarm bells were justified. One of the speakers at the talk has several ASA adjudications against him for the promotion of live blood analysis. You can pay about $10,000 to become certified to take a drop of a blood from a patient, analyze it under a microscope, and then determine if the patient has any of, well, there are dozens of conditions listed. Anything from the state of the immune system to possible vitamin deficiencies can be detected. And it got worse. Another one of the speakers, how should I put this? He has views about AIDS and HIV that are not in line with the general scientific consensus. In fact, he has his own theory of disease. He states things like, a disease state like AIDS is a complex manifestation of nutritional deficiencies that include vitamins, minerals, plant hormones, amino acids, and enzymes. Or how about, promiscuous males may easily develop AIDS? Now, you are thinking, he's right about that. Promiscuity will change the risk levels. Well, the actual reason given is not because promiscuous males are having frequent unprotected sex with many partners. No, the reason actually is repeated ejaculations can deplete the male partner's blood of essential elements required by his immune system. And what about HIV? In this alternative theory of disease, apparently people can become susceptible to HIV by drinking fizzy drinks with artificial sweeteners. I'm sure this is totally coincidental, but on the same website where you can read about this theory of disease and how a lack of vitamins may leave you susceptible to HIV, well, conveniently, you can buy vitamin supplements. So, we had another case of science woozeum on our hands. Listen to Pod Illusion Live second birthday episode recording if you haven't heard the phrase science woozeum before. Or Google it to see Noodlemaz's blog post about it. In short, it refers to a recent incident where we believe the Science Museum uncritically promoted pseudoscience. Being good skeptics, a few of us got organised and complained, sending emails highlighting the sorts of claims being made by the speakers. The first thing we noticed was that the list of speakers was removed from the Dana website. The event was still listed, just the speakers' names were removed. After a few days of nagging, we eventually got the following response. This event is part of our generous host scheme, where we work with members of an African-Caribbean audience-led group to produce events. They identified this as a topic of interest to their community. We are aware that the content of this event is contentious, and asked the organizer to include speakers with strong scientific credentials. They were unable to do this. In circumstances when hosts are unable to find appropriate speakers, the Science Museum steps in, and we invite panel members with alternative and critical perspectives. Over the next few days, we learnt that the event would be cancelled if appropriate scientific speakers that could provide an opposing view were not found. And that has now nearly happened. We have been informed that the event has been postponed until they can find suitable speakers with scientific credentials. However, they do still intend to keep the original speakers and just add some critical speakers to the lineup. Is this a sceptical win? I think so. Is it stifling free speech? I don't think so. We wouldn't have got involved if the talk was at a venue other than the Science Museum. The Science Museum should be promoting science, not pseudoscience, and it certainly should not be providing a "I was invited to speak at the Science Museum" marketing soundbite for vitamin salespeople. Of course, as the event has only been postponed, the speakers will still be able to claim this once the event is rearranged, so there is still sceptical activism work to do. Realising I'm about to commit a slippery slope logical fallacy, what next? A creationism talk at the Natural History Museum? This is a report, read by Alex Foster and written by Kash Farouk, with help from Alan Hennis of the Nightingale Collaboration, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
So they say that the past is a foreign country, and I can sort of believe it. The 1970s had high oil prices, endless economic uncertainty, and the American government intervening to kick out foreign leaders they didn't like. How the kids of today can relate to it, I have no idea. But it was certainly an interesting period. The Oil Kings is a huge monograph discussing the volatile situation in terms of the world economy and the oil crisis in the late 70s. Set against the context of the unfolding Watergate scandal, Andrew Scott Cooper capitalises on newly declassified documents to draw a very different picture of this period than what has been revealed in the memoirs of people like Nixon and Kissinger. Liz Luckendorf had a chat with the author Andrew Scott Cooper about some of the new revelations. Liz started by asking him to explain a bit about the book.
Yeah, this is a book that takes you behind the scenes of really U.S. oil diplomacy with countries in the Middle East in the 1970s. And this is a really pivotal period because this is the time when the United States, for the first time, becomes dependent on Middle East oil producers to supply it with enough oil to meet demand at home. So there's a series of crucial events happened during this period. There's Watergate, there's the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, there is the Arab oil embargo, and then there's the oil shock. And these events are very important in helping to shape the final chapter of the Cold War. And to some extent, the United States, I think, is still, the U.S. economy is still grappling with the effects of this period.
The book was made possible by a lot of new sources becoming available. What was available before? What kind of picture was there? And how much did these new sources change the perspective of what happened in this period?
It sounds strange to say, but there was virtually no primary source documentation until the past couple of years. And what you're seeing in my book, in some cases, in some ways, I think for someone who studies this issue or is interested in U.S.-Iran-Saudi relations, it's almost like King Tut's tomb, because we have original transcripts of conversations between President Nixon and President Ford and with their domestic advisors like Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, but also foreign heads of state like the Shah of Iran and princes, Saudi princes. And this is really important because until now, we could only really go on what the policymakers, such as Henry Kissinger, were telling us in their memoirs. And one thing I try to do in the book is compare what Kissinger told us happened with what we now know actually happened. And if you read the book, you're going to see pretty remarkable discrepancies.
I was just constantly amazed at how different the relations were, because I was, you know, born in 81, so the Iranian Revolution had already happened and been much established fact by the time I was an adult. So just things like students holding up pictures of Khomeini, and, you know, that would being a good thing, is astounding. Was that more of a reaction against what was happening in Iran in terms of, like, the secularization and anti-Americanism, or did they just really think he had some good ideas? Like, it's hard to imagine that.
That's a terrific question, and a lot of young Iranians today, the children of the young generation that made the revolution, are very upset with their parents' generation. And they will say to them, how on earth could you support Khomeini against the Shah? Because, the Shah ran a dictatorship, but we now know it was a fairly soft dictatorship in terms of what was going on inside Iran, especially compared to what came later on. I think the young Iranians at that time, they were acting out. Remember, this was the period of the 60s and 70s. Student activism was at an all-time high, and that student activism hit Iran a couple of years after it hit the West. So by the time it got to Iran in the mid-1970s, student activism in the West had started to die down. I think there was tremendous naivete on the part of young Iranians, partly because the Shah forbade the image or the words of Khomeini to be published or shown in Iranian media. And so Khomeini, to some extent, because of the censorship, becomes this iconic figure. Almost, it sounds crazy, but at that time, he could have been seen as someone like a Nelson Mandela. I mean, he was described in Western news reports during the revolution. He was compared to Gandhi. This is a guy who, when he seized power, ordered the slaughter of thousands and thousands of opponents of the regime. So, yes, those young people were acting out. Some of them were on the far left, but they embraced a right-wing religious figure because he was the best hope they saw of taking the Shah down. I've met people who protested during that time against the Shah, and they have said to me how ashamed they are that they did that, and they realized they made a huge mistake.
And one of the things I noticed about reading the book was similarities with how oil is discussed today in relations. Mostly, you know, there was a massive banking crisis and skyrocketing oil prices, and I was just going, how is this, you know, is this today? It's there's just so many of the issues that are now kind of the same. Is misinterpretation on my part, or are there similarities with today? And
yeah, I mean, I think there are some real parallels. I should say that the revelations I have in the book about the banking crisis have not been written in any other history of this period. This is the first book where you'll see that linkage coming in between high oil prices destabilizing the financial sector. If you go back to the financial crisis in 2008, actually you really go back to 2007, which is when it starts in the UK with Northern Rock, there are scholars and analysts, Nouriel Roubini is probably the most prominent one, who made the linkage between the oil shock of 2007 to 2008 being the last straw in some respects for a financial system and a Western-style world economy that was already on the brink of a crisis. I mean, the structure was so vulnerable that sudden surge in oil prices doubled between the summer of 07 and the summer of 08. They went from about $74 a barrel to $145 a barrel. Think about that. That is so high, and that happened so quickly. And I'm sure that you can remember that time when people were like, wow, oil prices are so high, and somehow we're getting away with it. Well, we didn't get away with it. And in fact, what you're seeing now in Southern Europe is a great financial crisis. Partly that is because they can't pay, and they are they're struggling to pay their fuel bills. Libyan oil has been a key part of the Southern European economy since the early 1970s, and it's very important from the perspective of the Europeans to get Libyan oil pumping again and at full production as fast as possible into Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, because obviously those countries are a lot of trouble.
But the Shah of Iran himself seemed really prophetic. There was this lovely paragraph where he basically says, you know, the West needs to become energy independent. You know, we're going to go to solar and tidal. We're going to harness all these energy sources. And to a large extent, it's happening now.
He was an interesting guy. He has been caricatured in many ways. At the time of the revolution, he was caricatured and demonized as this bloodthirsty tyrant, almost like an Iranian Stalin. That just was not the case. We now know that the Shah was, in some respects, actually a very gentle man. He ran a tough shop, there's no doubt about it, and he turned a blind eye to abuses and excesses in the system. But this was a guy who also had some time on his hands to do a lot of thinking, and he was absolutely obsessed with oil, as any Iranian leader has to be. I mean, Ahmadinejad today will be totally focused on oil prices, because in order for Iran to meet its budgetary requirements, oil prices have to not fall beneath a certain threshold. You know, if Iran wants to balance the books, they have to sort of anticipate they're going to have so much money coming in for the next year. And the Shah was very prophetic. And that paragraph you quoted, I was doing an interview while I was in the United States, and actually the interviewer read the entire paragraph out. And the part, of course, that people are looking at is where the Shah talks about he says, this is in 1973, he says, one of these days you're going to have to go and start looking for oil under the North Pole, and you're going to have to start using solar power, and you're going to have to start using the power of the oceans. And he was very prophetic, and at that time he was dismissed as crazy. Well, we now know that actually the Shah was right. We are at that point, and the low-hanging fruit has been picked. We're now having to do deep-sea drilling, oil drilling. This is extremely dangerous. It carries great risk of environmental catastrophe. And unfortunately, it really delays the transition of the world economy to one that is based more on renewable energy resources rather than on this old hydrocarbon model, which is so outdated and so 20th century.
Well, there's so many things that we could not touch on, because it is a huge book. Thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating.
That's great talking to you. It was a very relaxed conversation.
You can hear a longer version of this interview, which also talks about Iranian politics and energy independence, on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, in this next report, Nick Borer explains why he thinks we should reevaluate sentimental views of history and question some of the historical narratives that we take for granted. Now, I think his report is absolutely brilliant, but is this just my memory clouded by sentimentality for a report that never truly existed? To find out, here's Nick Borer.
We are constantly reminded of our great history as Britons, as Americans, as Chinese. A history which is asserted to be an essential part not only of our identity as a society, but also of ourselves as individuals. I find his idea not only truly bizarre, but also highly deceitful. Yet it pervades our society and culture in such a profound way that it is taken by almost everybody to be self-evidently true. The first and most obvious problem with this is the difficulty in pinning down exactly what this shared national history actually is. Is the part of my historical identity comprising the Great Depression that experienced by the Rothschilds, by the Mitford sisters, by Churchill? Or is it the depression of the Jarrow Marches? Of course, history as seen as a science of the past encompasses all of these discrete histories, and many more, and can examine the connections between them. But this is far too complex and incoherent to form a cohesive part of our national and individual identities. This problem is further compounded by the fact that for huge swathes of nearly every society, if we go back more than two or three generations at most, the personal family histories of many people are radically different from their own national history. What connection does someone whose ancestors came to Britain in the 1950s to drive London's buses have to do with the Britain inhabited by Queen Elizabeth I or the Venerable Bede? Which leads me to my next point. How are we, any of us, actually supposed to be connected to our history? How can we be proud and patriotic about something that we did not take part in and over which we had no possible influence or control? How can I be proud of two world wars and one world cup when I was neither conceived nor conceived of at the time they occurred? Indeed, given my general incompetence and utter lack of sporting prowess, I suspect that had I been around and able to participate in these events, the outcomes might have been rather spectacularly and catastrophically different. To define myself by means of such events seems to me to be as bizarre as defining myself by reference to my support for a hypothetical football or netball team. And my selection of these totemic 20th century events, held by football supporters to be the overriding factors in defining their difference from German football supporters, points to another major problem with this abuse of history. The historical narratives we construct both individually and as societies are hopelessly partial, in both senses of the word, and highly selective. Do we define ourselves by reference to Francis Drake, the state-sponsored terrorist and pirate, or Sir Francis Drake, the noble explorer? Are we formed by the great British Empire that brought civilization and railways to the benighted savages? Or the British Empire that casually and needlessly condemned millions of Indians to starvation and preventable famines? It's the Churchill of whom we are so proud, the Winnie who won the war. Or the Winston who gleefully gassed the Marsh Arabs, an act that incidentally led to the hangman's noose when repeated by a subsequent ruler of Mesopotamia. This sentimental selectivity pervades not only our own national identity, but also what that we create for other nations and societies. France is not seen as the country that took the radical and far-reaching step of overthrowing feudalism and paving the way for the modern constitutional republican democracies of the Western world, but rather, to repeat one of the most noxiously defamatory quotes of the modern era, a nation of cheese-eating surrender monkeys. Germany is not the Germany of Goethe and Schiller, nor the Germany of the Weimar Republic, but rather that of jackboots, brown shirts, and rigid right arms. Moreover, we are so profoundly ignorant of so much of our own history, and even more so of that of other societies. It is difficult to see how we can claim to be formed and shaped and connected to a history of which we know nothing. And this is not just a problem of selectivity and ignorance, but also one of willful deceit and unconscious self-deception. National historical narratives are created that bear little or no resemblance to objective reality, but which come to dominate national discourse to such an extent as to drown out rational introspection. Britain before the Human Rights Act was the freest country in the world, according to Mad Melanie Phillips. America is the land of the free. China is the once downtrodden victim of brutal foreigners, now finally rising up to vanquish its former oppressors. History is thereby fetishized and glorified to become little more than insidious propaganda used to support and drive conservative agendas to return us to a supposedly golden age when we, or previous incarnations of ourselves, presumably, were actually happy and secure. A clear example of this is found in many Commonwealth countries, where it is claimed that homosexuality is an alien phenomenon never seen in their countries and societies before the arrival of the Brits. This is utterly false historical narrative and is then used to drive murderously homophobic political agendas. The study of history is vital. It enables us to understand how we arrived at where we are today as a society. We must understand past events to avoid making the same mistakes again. But in this sense, its value is descriptive and explanatory, not a means of constructing an identity. Where a society has been in the past should have little bearing on what it does now and the direction it takes in the future. Of course, certain institutional means, most notably the law, the past does exert some control over us. But just as we generally do not allow the law to confine us and hold us hostage to fortune, but rather continually engage in a process of refinement, reform, and occasionally revolution, so we must never allow history to define and identify us. We are all individuals, and our responsibility is not to our history and to people from the past who will never be able to appreciate the fruits of our hard work, but rather to those who share our world today, or who will have to inherit it in the future. In my opinion, we would do rather better as society if we realised that it is the proximate causal factors resulting directly from contemporary political and societal decisions that have the greatest effect on contemporary society and the lives of real people, not mystical notions of the transcendent nature of our connection to a mythical national historical narrative. We would then be rather better placed to understand and empathise with those who rioted in the summer, and to take constructive steps to change society to make sure it doesn't happen again, rather than yearning from a golden era when it would have received a clip around the ear and never have misbehaved again. This is Nick Borer for The Pod Delusion.
We're staying with alternative therapies now, so listen up, especially if you've got candles in your ears, which may make hearing this next report by Tom Williamson tricky. If you've never heard of it before, that's literally what it is, putting candles in your ears. Tom has been speaking to someone who actually does ear candling to find out more. On next week's show, in the interests of fairness and balance, we'll have someone who makes candles out of ears as a counterpoint. Here's Tom Williamson.
Today we're talking about ear candling. Joining me today is Andrew Skeets, a complementary therapist and author of Ear Candling and Other Treatments for Ear, Nose and Throat Problems. Andrew, good evening.
Good evening, Tom.
Could you just tell the audience about yourself and your experience with ear candling?
Yes, certainly, Tom. I've been a qualified complementary therapist, started in April 1987, massage, sports massage. And then one day I chanced upon looking at an ear candling session going on at a health show. I thought, well, this looks interesting. How do I learn to do it? And they said, go up to Coventry, and that's where you can get a qualification. I lived in London at that time. Since then, I've written my book, which you introduced. I've done a DVD, and I guess I've taught over 2,000 students all over the country. And I've also treated probably about, I have done about 500 or 600 treatments. So I must have seen about 5,000 or 6,000 ear candles being burned.
Just for the uninitiated, what exactly is ear candling?
Okay, well, ear candling is the placement of a special tube, which is normally a cotton or a linen, which is normally impregnated with different herbs. It's placed at the entrance of the outer ear canal, and the warmth from the ear candle goes into the ear canal, and hopefully it is then transmitted through the rest of the head. So it affects the sinuses and the nasal areas and the lymphatic point. It's also, as well as the physical action of the warmth, there's the aromatherapy effects of the different oils which are impregnated, the honey and the beeswax, which form the rest of the candle. So you've got that, and there's also the relaxation part of the treatment.
As far as I'm aware, the residue that you see at the end of an ear candling treatment, that is the residue that's just left over from the candle. Is that right?
That's quite correct. One of the two biggest myths in ear candling is that ear candling will remove earwax. Well, it doesn't do that. I had a laboratory, accredited laboratory attached to the University of Reading, proved they analysed and compared unburnt and burnt ear candles. They did about 4 or 5 different tests, and all the information's in my book. Certainly, this is one of the most important things to tell people when you're opening up the candles, that any wax that's found inside a used ear candle is from the candle itself and not from the ear. And I'm driven nuts by when people, such as two clients who came in for a massage about half an hour ago, said, we were told in Birmingham that the wax in the candle was from the ear. And I can categorically state, and I will bet with any therapist, that any earwax found in the candle is from the candle itself, not from the ear.
Okay. Now, to me, that sounds like quite a controversial position to take as an ear candler. Are there any other aspects of ear candling that you're outspoken on?
Well, I suppose being outspoken is speaking the truth. And the next big myth, and one that I was taken in by, was the fact that the Hopi tribe in North America, southwestern United States, were the main inventors of ear candling. So you will see on lots of websites, and lots of therapists will call themselves Hopi ear candlers. They do Hopi ear candling. That's completely wrong. And in fact, the company which makes best ear candles and the safest, I hope you asked me about that, they actually perpetrated or propagated this idea that pictures found in a wall in Arizona were actually painted hundreds of years ago. Well, in fact, they were painted in 1932 as part of the Roosevelt drive to get people back to work. So that's something that I don't think I'm very popular with other therapists, because they'd obviously have to change all their websites.
Now, you mentioned safety. With ear candling, you have hot wax. And have there been any incidents of the hot wax burning people, and what safety precautions are there in place?
Right, okay. I know that in America there have been a lot of reports about damage to people's ears and eardrums through hot wax falling onto them. And I can quite understand why doctors such as Dr. Seeley in the United States, who did a report on ear candling, come up to the conclusion that ear candling is dangerous. The biggest difference between ear candles that are used in America and the ones that are used here, there are some exceptions in America, is that most of them are either handmade by small companies or by individuals, and they don't have any filter to stop the ear wax dripping in. I should say that it's important for anybody going to have an ear candling session in this country, in the United Kingdom, to make sure that the therapist has got proper insurance cover. And this is something that I always point out to people when they come to my my clinic for whatever treatment. I show them my qualification certificate and also my insurance certificate. Now, I too would be very, very worried if there were ear candles being used in Great Britain that didn't have a filter in to stop, an internal filter to stop wax dropping down into the ear, didn't have a marker line to tell the therapist when they could stop. I didn't have a seam on the candle which can be used to deflect away anything that may fall off if it's been done in a draft, which occasionally is done. Also, I use my ear cloth, which I have invented in Japanese, to protect the person's face. So, as I say, the insurance companies will cover this treatment as long as the person has got proper cover. If problems occur, very often when people do it themselves or they do it with their friends as a lark, see what's going to happen. Like anything, you can't have 100% success rate in life. It's only the tax man in death that proves that. So go to a properly qualified, insured therapist. When you ring up somebody, just say, will the ear candles remove ear wax? If they say yes, then you don't touch them with a barge pole.
Certainly some interesting and very frank advice. Andrew Skeets, thank you for joining me this evening.
Thank you, Tom. Bye now.
Finally this week, Drew Ray has been having some impure thoughts about scepticism. Many people who listen to this programme will probably identify as a sceptic, but what good is a label if we can't compete over who is the best? To remedy this, here's Drew with a simple test.
Here's a little bit of Friday morning pod delusion fun. The sceptic movement often gets caught up in self-examination. Are we misogynist? Can you be a sceptic and still believe in God? Is don't be a dick a motto to live by, or cowardly appeasement? Are we sceptical enough? What does it mean to be a sceptic, anyway? Fortunately, for questions like these, you don't really need philosophy or science. You just need a meme so old, it's been around long before the concept of memes was invented. In fact, it's an internet meme that predates the internet. The first recorded purity test was in 1936, but it's pretty clear that students had been playing games like this for some time even back then. A purity test consists of a set of questions about acts that you've engaged in, The object is to answer yes to as many questions as possible, with each affirmative answer lowering your purity. Total corruption is a badge of honour. The earliest purity tests were sexual in nature, but since then purity tests of all kinds have become popular. They've pretty much died out now in favour of those stupid Facebook "Which Twilight character are you?" quizzes. But they still remind me of the good old days when Archie was the only search engine, and there were weekly Usenet summaries of all of the new web pages that had been created that week. I'm embarrassed to admit that back then I scored as very corrupt on the hacker purity test and didn't actually understand most of the questions on the sex purity test. So, how about you? Are you pure, or are you a truly active skeptic? Just answer these simple questions. As a rough scoring guide, each yes answer is worth about 5 points. Have you ever taken a public homeopathic overdose? Have you ever marched to protest religion or to support funding for science? Have you ever organised a sceptical protest? Do you regularly listen to at least one sceptical podcast? Give yourself 1 point for each podcast up to the first 5 that you listen to. Have you ever contributed to a sceptical podcast? Do you contribute regularly, perhaps? Have you ever donated money to a sceptic group or cause? Have you ever argued on the internet against a conspiracy theorist? Have you ever written a post for a sceptical blog? Do you perhaps even contribute regularly to a sceptical blog? Have you ever taken part in a public sceptical debate? Have you attended a Skeptics in the Pub? Have you spoken at a Skeptics in the Pub? Have you organised a Skeptics in the Pub? Have you ever sat and listened politely and with an open mind to a true believer? Give yourself 5 extra points if you refrain from making jokes or rude remarks afterwards. Have you ever identified your own cherished beliefs and examined the evidence for them? Give yourself a bonus 5 points if you changed your mind as a result, and another 5 points if you've done that since becoming a skeptic. Have you ever engaged in skeptical examination of the skeptic movement? Have you ever done original research to investigate a paranormal claim? And have you introduced others to skepticism? I've put an automatic version of that linked from the Poddelusion webpage. Have a go, and more importantly, give yourself a goal to try to improve your score. Just think about it. You could get a 5% bump just for contributing a piece for the Poddelusion, and another 5% if you click the donate button. Just think of James's begging message as sweet talk trying to corrupt you. This is Drew Ray for the Poddelusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can hear Liz's full interview with Andrew Scott Cooper about the Oil Kings. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and find out how to get involved with the show yourself. And now for some very awkward begging. If you like the Poddelusion and would like to support what we do, why not head over to our website and subscribe to donate £5 or £10 a month to keep the show going. You can also make one-off donations. The Poddelusion this week was brought to you by Michael Greyer, Pratik Butch, Tessa Kendall, Cash Farouk, Alex Foster, Liz Luckendorf, Nick Borer, Tom Williamson, Drew Ray, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf, and special thanks to the Milton Keynes Skeptics for putting up with me recording this. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a part of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Dr. Kirkland, thank you for agreeing to see me. I must say, your report has gotten us at Xenoglax Pharmaceuticals very excited.
We've never seen anything quite like it, Mr. Jansen. We've managed to literally halt the signs of aging.
Well, we've put millions into this research, Dr. Kirkland. If you finally got into this holy grail, it will be money well spent.
Well, let me show you what we have, Mr. Jansen. Would you like to look into this glass case?
Those mice certainly do look young. I can't help wondering, though, how the world would benefit from having younger-looking mice. More strenuous workouts for lazy house cats, maybe?
Sir, we can apply this knowledge to human medicine. We've been able to eliminate muscle wasting, cataracts, and even prevent wrinkling.
But what I can't understand is how you really know the difference between an old or young mouse.
I would say the visual evidence is clear enough, Mr. Jansen.
Well, you might say that, Dr. Kirkland. I, however, would say that the visual evidence suggests that these are actually young mice made to look like older mice.
What? How dare you? Why would you suggest such a thing?
Firstly, I would say the best way to make a mouse seem older is not to dress it up in a tiny flat cap, long brown coat, and paint white stripes in its hair with Tippex. Secondly, sitting them on small sofas in front of a miniature television showing episodes of Countdown is not that convincing. And thirdly, you seem to have left this receipt in plain view from Max's Mouse-O-Rama for a delivery of 24 mice only yesterday. Might you be playing me for extra funds, Dr. Kirkland?
Could be an admin error. Well, let me show you this instead. We've honestly stopped the signs of aging in this youthful-looking parrot just here.
What? Party wants a bus pass?
Oh, sod off.